Good morning and welcome to Claude Daily, your morning briefing on everything Claude and Anthropic. I'm Alex and it is Friday, June 12th, 2026.
And I'm Sam. And Alex, I have to say, I was reading ahead on today's content before we started recording and I actually had to put my phone down and take a breath because there's some stuff today that I think is genuinely going to land differently for developers than a lot of what we cover.
You say that every Friday.
I know I do, but this time I mean it more than usual.
Huh. Okay, so here's what we've got. Our main story today comes from the Claude Code documentation. And this is one of those stories that sounds technical on the surface, but has real implications for how developers work day to day. We're talking about session management in Claude Code, and what it actually means to have persistent, branchable, project-tied conversations in an AI coding tool.
It's one of those features where you hear the description and you think, obviously this should exist, and then you realize it hasn't worked this well before and you feel a little cheated.
That's honestly a pretty accurate emotional description of how I'd characterize it.
Thank you.
And then we've got a wide-ranging look at what's been happening in the broader AI and tech news space this week, because it has been a busy one out there. Competition, regulation, research, a lot of threads to pull on.
There's always a lot of threads to pull on. I feel like we say that, and then the threads just keep multiplying.
They just keep multiplying. It's the nature of the moment we're in, I think. All right, let's start with the main event. Okay. Claude Code Session Management. So this is documented in the official Claude Code docs, and I want to take some time here because I think this deserves more than a quick summary.
Yes, please.
So here's the fundamental thing. Sessions in Claude Code are saved conversations that are tied to specific project directories. They're stored locally on your machine, as what the documentation calls continuous local transcripts. And from that foundation, you get three major capabilities. You can resume prior sessions, you can branch conversations to explore different approaches, and you can switch between different tasks without losing context or progress.
Okay, so I want to just stop here for a second because I think it's worth grounding this in the actual pain point for developers, because if you haven't used AI coding tools heavily, you might not feel immediately why this is exciting.
Please.
So here's the scenario. You're working on a complex feature. Maybe you're refactoring a data layer, or you're debugging something gnarly across multiple files, or you're building out an API integration that requires understanding a bunch of context about how your code base is structured. And you've been working with Claude in Claude Code for, let's say, an hour or two. You've built up this whole shared understanding. The AI knows your architecture. It knows the decisions you've made. It knows why certain things are the way they are.
It's like a collaborator who's been in the weeds with you.
Exactly. It's like a collaborator who's been in the weeds with you, and then you close your terminal to go do something else. Maybe you've got a meeting. Maybe you have to jump to a different project that's on fire. Maybe it's just the end of the day.
And then you come back.
And historically, that conversation is gone. You're starting fresh, and you have to reestablish all of that context. Here's the project. Here's what it does. Here's where we are in this particular work. Here's why we've made certain decisions.
And that reestablishment isn't free. It takes time, it takes effort, and you never quite get back to exactly the same shared understanding you had before.
You never quite get there. The reconstructed context is always a little thinner than the lived context. So you've lost something real.
And Claude Code Session Management is solving that. You come back, you resume the session, and the full transcript of that conversation is right there.
The full history, not a summary, not a truncated version, the actual thread of the conversation.
Right. And the documentation is clear that these are stored locally, which has some interesting implications we should get into.
Oh, definitely. Let's get into that.
So they're stored locally on your machine, tied to the project directory, which means they travel with your project in a natural way. It's not something being managed in some cloud service somewhere. It lives alongside your code.
Which is a design choice that I find pretty thoughtful. Because the session is context about your code, and your code lives locally, or it lives in a repo that you pull locally, so it makes sense for those things to be collocated.
It's also a privacy and security consideration that enterprise developers are going to appreciate. Your conversation about your proprietary code base is staying on your machine.
Oh, that's a huge point for enterprise. Like, if you're working on a startup's unreleased product, or you're at a large company working on something confidential, the idea that your detailed technical discussions about that code are all living locally rather than being uploaded somewhere, that matters.
It matters a lot. And it's not a concession. It's actually the right architectural choice regardless of the privacy angle. Because it means the session can work offline, It means latency to access session history is essentially zero. It means you're not dependent on a cloud service being up to resume your work.
Right. The robustness of local storage. Your history is always there when you need it because it's just a file on your computer.
Now, the branching capability. This is the one I want to spend the most time on because I think it represents the biggest shift in how developers can actually use this tool.
Yes, okay. Let's talk about branching because this is really good.
Set it up.
All right, so here's the scenario. You're deep in a session, you've been building out some feature, and you hit a decision point. Classic engineering decision point. You've got two ways you could go. Option A is simpler, quicker to implement, probably handles 90% of the cases fine, but there's this edge case you're not sure about. Option B is more complex, takes longer to build, but it's cleaner architecturally and handles all the edge cases.
The right solution versus the practical solution trade-off.
Exactly. Except they might both be right depending on constraints you don't fully know yet. Like, maybe option B is the right choice if this code is going to get more traffic than expected, but if it stays at current scale, option A is perfectly fine. And you don't know which world you're in.
Previously, what do you do?
Previously, you just kind of pick one and go. Or you ask Claude to explore both in the same conversation, which gets messy. Like the thread of the conversation gets tangled trying to hold both possibilities simultaneously.
The AI is trying to serve two hypotheticals at once.
Right. And the conversation quality suffers. You get hedging, you get conditional advice, you get, well, if you go with A, then X, but if you go with B, then Y in every response.
Which is useful, but not as useful as going deep on each path.
Not as useful as actually going deep on each. So with branching, you can fork your session at that decision point. You say, okay, I'm going to branch here. You go down path A in one branch. Fully explore it, see how it plays out, see if the edge case is as bad as you feared. Maybe it's fine. Then you go back to the branch point and go down path B. Fully explore that, understand the complexity cost, understand the real benefit.
And then you can compare them as separate, complete explorations rather than as competing hypotheticals inside one confused conversation.
Exactly. And you keep both branches. So if you decide to go with A, but a month from now, you find out that edge case was more important than you thought, you can go back to the branch point where you had the path B conversation and pick that up.
That's quite powerful. Because the decision is preserved. The reasoning behind it is preserved.
And this maps so naturally to how developers already think about their work, which is the thing that keeps striking me about this whole feature set. Like, Git branches are already in every developer's mental toolkit. They understand branching as a concept. They understand the idea of exploring something without committing to it.
And now that mental model extends to the AI conversation layer.
Now it extends to the conversation layer, which is just the right abstraction. It's not inventing something new. It's applying a familiar pattern to a new context.
And the CLI, the command line interface, supports all of this with specific commands. It's not a buried feature you have to hunt for.
Right. It's a first-class citizen in the Claude Code command line experience, which means it's scriptable, automatable, integratable into your existing developer workflow.
That's a significant thing. Because developers have dev environments, they have scripts, they have aliases, they have makefiles, whatever their personal toolkit looks like. A feature that's accessible only through a graphical interface sits outside that toolkit. A feature that's command line native can be woven into it.
And the category of developer who's using Claude Code heavily is probably a developer who has a very intentional command line workflow. So meeting them where they are is the right call.
What about the task switching piece? Because that's the third capability, and I think it's worth making sure we cover it.
Task switching is almost the most practically impactful one, I think, even though it sounds the most mundane.
Tell me why.
Okay, so how many developers work on one project at a time?
Not many.
Not many. Most developers are juggling at least two or three things at any given time. There's the main feature they're building. There's the bug that came in yesterday that needs a hot fix. There's the code review they owe someone. There's the small side project they're experimenting with. And these things don't respect each other's timelines.
You get interrupted.
You get constantly interrupted. And the cost of interruption in software development is famously high. There's all this research about how long it takes to get back into a state of flow after an interruption.
People quote the number like it's 20 minutes, right? To get back to full context.
Something like that. And with AI coding tools, the interruption cost has this extra tax on it, which is not just getting yourself back into the problem, but getting the AI back into the problem too. Because if you had to start a new conversation for every interruption, you're paying that front-loading cost every time.
But with session management, you're not. You switch to the other task, which has its own session tied to its own project directory. Do what you need to do there, and then when you come back to your original work, the session is exactly where you left it.
You walk back in and pick up mid-sentence, essentially. The AI has the full context of everything you were doing. You don't have to rebuild it.
Which across a full workday and across a full development cycle, that's an enormous cumulative time saving.
Enormous. And these are the kinds of improvements that are hard to see in a benchmark, but are immediately, viscerally real when you experience them. Like you use it for a week and you don't know how you worked before.
The how did I live without this category of feature?
The exact category.
I want to come back to something you said earlier about the session transcripts being locally stored, because you raised an interesting point about them potentially serving as a kind of log of your development reasoning. Say more about that.
Yeah, so this is a use case that I think is kind of a surprise bonus that most people won't think about immediately. So there's this thing in software engineering called architectural decision records. The idea is that you document, in a structured way, not just what you decided, but why you decided it. What the alternatives were, what trade-offs you weighed, what led you to the final choice.
And these are notoriously hard to maintain because nobody wants to write them in the moment.
Nobody wants to write them. You're in the middle of building something, you're focused, you've got the context in your head, and stopping to write a formal document about why you chose one approach over another, it feels like overhead that slows you down.
So they either don't get written or they get written retroactively and they're incomplete.
And retroactively, they're incomplete because you've already forgotten half the reasoning. But if you've been working through those decisions in a Claude Code session, if you've been talking through the trade-offs with the AI, that reasoning is already written down. It's in the transcript.
It's not formatted as a formal document, but the information is there.
The information is there. And if you wanted to, you could ask Claude to summarize the key decisions and their rationale from the session. Turn the messy transcript into something structured.
That's a legitimate workflow. Use the session transcript as the raw material for actual documentation.
Right. And for code bases where institutional knowledge is a problem, where people leave and take their context with them, where 6 months later, nobody remembers why a certain module works the way it does, your Claude Code sessions become part of the institutional memory.
That's a really compelling case for organizations. And it changes the value proposition of the sessions from just save my work to create a record of how the work happened.
And honestly, for onboarding too, if I join a team and I can look at the Claude Code session transcripts for the major features I'm going to be working on, I can see the reasoning, the alternatives considered, the dead ends explored.
That's a much richer onboarding resource than even good written documentation, because it shows the thinking, not just the conclusions.
It shows the thinking, not just the conclusions. Good documentation tells you what, session transcripts tell you why.
This is genuinely one of those features that I think will generate uses that the people who designed it didn't fully anticipate.
Oh, for sure, that's always a good sign. When a feature is solid enough that people start using it in ways beyond the intended use cases, you've built something with real depth.
All right, the documentation for all of this is detailed and worth reading carefully if you're a Claude Code user, or if you're evaluating Claude Code for your team or organization. The session management documentation walks you through not just the commands, but the conceptual model, which is the right way to write developer documentation.
It is. Give people the mental model first, the commands you can look up. Understanding why something works the way it does. That's the thing you need the docs for.
All right, so that's our main story today. A really significant quality of life and workflow improvement for Claude Code users, with some interesting deeper implications. Now let's widen the lens. So there's been a lot happening in the broader AI and technology news space this week, and I want to run through several of the themes that have been coming up across coverage. Starting with the competitive picture in AI coding tools, because I think the Claude Code session management story sits inside a much bigger context there.
Oh, the coding tools market right now is just, it's intense. Like the competition for developer mindshare is genuinely ferocious.
It is. And I think what's interesting about where we are right now is that the competition is increasingly happening on workflow dimensions rather than raw capability dimensions. A year or two ago, the differentiators were things like code quality, context window size, how well the AI understood complex code bases. And those still matter, but they've become more table stakes.
Because the ceiling on all of them has risen so much that the gaps between the major tools are smaller than they used to be.
Right. And when capability gaps narrow, the competition moves to experience. How does this tool fit into how I actually work? Does it slow me down with friction? Does it feel natural to use? Can I build a sustainable workflow around it?
Which is exactly the dimension that session management addresses. And that's why I think the framing of it as a developer experience update undersells it a bit. It's actually a competitive positioning move.
Describe what you mean.
Okay, so developer tools in general. Once a developer commits to a tool and builds their workflow around it, switching costs are high. It's not just learning new commands. It's the accumulated knowledge in your configuration, in your scripts, in your muscle memory. And now with Claude Code Session Management, you can add your accumulated conversation context to that list. Your sessions are a kind of investment in the tool.
The more sessions you build up, the more valuable the tool becomes to you.
And correspondingly, the more costly it becomes to leave, which is sticky. That's a genuinely good strategy for building a developer tool business.
And it's stickiness that's earned rather than manufactured. Like, you're not making it artificially hard to leave. You're creating genuine value that lives inside the tool.
Which is the right kind of stickiness.
There's been some interesting data circulating this week about enterprise AI coding tool adoption broadly. I don't want to cite specific numbers because there's a lot of variation in how these surveys are conducted, but the directional story is very clear. The majority of professional software engineers at large companies are now using AI assistants in their daily work in some meaningful way.
And this was not true like 18 months ago. The speed of adoption has been remarkable.
It has. And the conversation inside these organizations has shifted dramatically. It's no longer, should we allow developers to use AI tools? It's, which tools are we standardizing on and what are our best practices for using them?
That's a significant shift in framing, from gatekeeping to governance.
From gatekeeping to governance, exactly. And the governance questions are genuinely interesting. How do you handle code review when AI is generating a larger percentage of the code? How do you think about accountability for AI-generated code? How do you make sure developers are staying engaged with the code deeply enough to maintain it, not just shipping it?
The code review one is particularly interesting to me, because if your developers are producing 50% more code per week because of AI assistance, your code review capacity probably hasn't scaled proportionally.
Unless AI is also doing some of the code review.
Which is happening. And I find it both elegant and slightly strange. You have AI generating code, and then AI reviewing the code generated by AI, and then a human somewhere in the loop trying to make sense of all of it.
It's a new kind of collaboration model.
It's a very new kind of collaboration model, and I don't think we've fully worked out what good looks like in that model yet.
There were some interesting discussions this week about what this means for junior developers specifically, and I think it's one of the more important under-discussed questions in the industry.
Oh, this is something I think about a lot, because the path to becoming a senior engineer, historically, has involved a lot of, let's say, formative suffering, writing boilerplate, grinding through repetitive code, making mistakes and having to debug them yourself. That process is how you learn to think like a software engineer.
It's the apprenticeship model, essentially. You do the work and the work teaches you.
Right. And if AI is doing a significant chunk of that work from day one, does the learning still happen? Do you develop the same depth of intuition?
I don't think we know yet.
I don't think we know yet either. And I think the honest answer is that it probably depends enormously on how you use the tools. There's a version of using AI coding assistance that's very active. You're engaging with every piece of code the AI produces. You're understanding it, you're questioning it, you're learning from it. And there's a more passive version where you accept outputs without deeply engaging.
The passive version is the one that worries people.
Right, because in the passive version, you can produce working code without understanding it. And that's fine for some purposes, but it's not building expertise.
This feels like a conversation that computer science education is going to be having very loudly over the next few years.
It's already having it. The curricula haven't caught up to the tools, but the conversations are happening. And I think the direction is probably something like, you teach people to be good at working with AI, not just good at working without it. The evaluation criteria change.
How do you evaluate someone's engineering ability in a world where AI does a lot of the code generation?
You evaluate their judgment, their architectural thinking, their ability to reason about trade-offs, their understanding of systems, the higher order skills that the AI can help with, but can't replace.
Which might actually be a more authentic evaluation of software engineering ability than whether someone can write a particular algorithm from scratch.
You could argue that, though I'll push back a little and say there's still real value in the low-level understanding. Knowing what's happening at the machine level, understanding performance, understanding memory, those things don't become irrelevant just because the AI can generate code for you.
Fair pushback.
The foundation still matters. It's just that the foundation alone is no longer sufficient.
Let's shift to the regulatory front then, because there's been meaningful news there this week.
Yeah, the EU AI Act continues to be the main regulatory story.
We're now in a phase where some of the more consequential provisions are actively in effect, and the compliance conversations that were theoretical for a long time are now very concrete. Companies are making real decisions about product design, data handling, and documentation requirements.
And I think the interesting thing about Anthropic's position here is that this is a company that took safety and transparency seriously as core values well before they were regulatory requirements. So the burden of compliance is genuinely lighter for them than for companies that are retrofitting.
That's a real strategic advantage. And it's one that wasn't obvious when Anthropic was making those investments early on.
Right. Like, if you were watching the market 2.5 years ago, you could have looked at Anthropic's emphasis on safety research and constitutional AI and interpretability and said, this is slowing them down. They're spending resources on things that don't directly improve capability benchmarks.
And now those investments are differentiators.
Now they're differentiators, and increasingly they're required. So the slow path turned out to be faster in important ways.
It's a version of the tortoise and the hare story.
A very high-stakes version of it, yeah.
There's also been interesting coverage this week from outside Europe. The United States regulatory picture continues to evolve. There's been ongoing activity at the federal level around AI standards and guidance, and the conversation about what federal AI legislation might look like is still very much alive, though the details remain contested.
The U.S. has taken a different approach than Europe. More industry collaboration, more voluntary commitments, less prescriptive regulation so far.
And there are legitimate arguments for and against that approach. The pro-innovation argument is that heavy regulation early constrains experimentation and puts American companies at a disadvantage.
And the pro-regulation argument is that waiting too long means problems get embedded before there's oversight.
Neither side is wrong. It's a genuine policy tension.
And I think the companies that are positioning well are the ones that are engaging seriously with both approaches. Like, they're not treating regulatory engagement as an adversarial thing. They're treating it as an opportunity to help shape sensible frameworks.
Which requires having genuine credibility on safety. You can't sit at the table and advocate for smart regulation if you haven't actually been doing the safety work.
Right? You have to have earned the seat.
Let's talk about AI agents, because this has been a big theme in the news and discussions this week, and it connects to some deeper questions about where AI is heading.
Ooh, okay, yes.
The progression from AI as an assistant that answers questions to AI as an agent that takes actions in the world. This is a major transition, and it's increasingly not theoretical.
It's in production. There are real AI agents running in real systems doing real things right now.
Right, and the implications are significant. When an AI answers a question wrong, the failure mode is bounded. You got a wrong answer, you maybe acted on it, you discover the error, you correct course.
Recoverable.
Recoverable. When an AI agent takes an action in the world, sends an email, modifies a file, makes an API call, runs code on a system, the failure modes are potentially less recoverable, and they can compound.
They can compound quickly, like one wrong action at the start of a sequence of actions.
Cascades.
And you might not notice until several steps later when the damage is done.
So the question of how you safely extend more autonomy to AI agents, how you maintain meaningful human oversight while still getting the value of automation, this is genuinely one of the hard problems in AI right now.
And I think Anthropic's public thinking on this has been pretty coherent. The staged approach, the emphasis on preserving human ability to intervene and course correct, the principle that AI systems should be cautious about taking irreversible actions even when they're confident.
Because confidence doesn't equal correctness.
Confidence doesn't equal correctness. And irreversible actions taken confidently but incorrectly are the worst case.
There's a concept that I've seen discussed in some of the research literature this week about this, the idea of minimal footprint. The idea that AI agents should, by default, request only the permissions they need, avoid storing information beyond immediate task needs, prefer reversible over irreversible actions.
Right. It's almost like the principle of least privilege from traditional security applied to AI autonomy.
Exactly the right analogy. Because in security, the principle of least privilege, give systems only the access they need for their specific task, exists to limit the blast radius of failures and compromises. The same logic applies here.
An AI agent that takes the minimal set of actions needed to accomplish its task, that prefers reversible options when available, that checks in before doing something that can't be undone. That agent is fundamentally safer to deploy than one that acts with maximum autonomy.
Even if the maximum autonomy version sometimes accomplishes things faster.
Even then, because you're trading peak efficiency for robustness and trustworthiness, and that's usually the right trade in a system you're deploying in important contexts.
The public discussion around AI agents this week has also touched on some interesting use cases in enterprise workflows. Agents that can move through multi-step processes, gathering information, doing analysis, producing outputs, without constant human intervention at each step.
And those use cases are real. Like, if you can take a workflow that used to require a human to shepherd it through 8 steps and hand it off to an agent that can do those 8 steps with appropriate checkpoints, that's real value.
The ROI there is visible and calculable.
Very calculable. And I think this is where a lot of the enterprise adoption energy is right now. Not let's replace a function with AI, but let's take this workflow that's been slowing us down and make it automatable.
That's a much more tractable and less contentious framing than replacement.
Much more tractable. You're solving a specific problem, you can measure the improvement, you can evaluate whether it's working.
There's been some significant news in the AI research space this week as well. The interpretability side of things specifically, the work on trying to understand what's actually happening inside large AI models.
This is the area I personally find most exciting. And I know it sounds technical and abstract, but the implications are so significant.
Explain why it matters.
Okay. So, you have these very powerful AI systems, and they produce useful outputs. But there's a meaningful sense in which even the people who built them don't fully understand why they produce the outputs they do. Like, the training process creates capabilities, but it doesn't come with a manual that says, here's why the model does X when you say Y.
It's a bit like you can describe a brain's behavior without understanding how the neurons produce that behavior.
Right, and interpretability research is essentially trying to build that understanding. Trying to figure out, okay, when the model does this thing, what circuits inside it are activating? What concepts is it representing and how? What's the internal mechanism of a particular behavior?
And Anthropic has been one of the leading labs on this. The mechanistic interpretability work.
Mechanistic interpretability, yes. And the progress has been real. There have been genuinely interesting results in the last year or so about how concepts are represented in these models, how information flows through them, how you can identify particular computational structures that correspond to particular behaviors.
And the implications for safety are direct.
Very direct. Because if you can look inside a model and understand why it does something, you can also identify when something might go wrong. You can verify that a model actually has the properties you want it to have, rather than just hoping it does based on its outputs.
Right now, you have to infer internal properties from external behavior, which is indirect and potentially incomplete.
Exactly. With interpretability, you can get more direct evidence. You can say, here is what the model is actually representing, here is what's actually driving this output. And that's a much stronger foundation for safety guarantees.
There were some interesting papers and discussions making the rounds this week on whether interpretability techniques are scaling well to the very largest and most capable models. What's your read on that?
It's a legitimate open question. The techniques that work well on smaller models sometimes don't transfer cleanly to the biggest ones. The complexity scales in ways that are challenging. But the directional progress is positive. The field is growing, there are more researchers working on it than ever, and the feeling I get from reading the discussions is cautiously optimistic.
Cautiously optimistic seems right.
Not triumphant, not we've solved this, but genuinely making progress on one of the hard problems.
Let's talk about the broader economic picture around AI infrastructure. Because there's been some significant coverage this week on capital expenditure, on data center investment, on the hardware side of all of this.
The numbers continue to be staggering.
Staggering. The investment flowing into AI infrastructure, compute, data centers, power, cooling, chips, is at a scale that was hard to imagine just a few years ago. And the question that keeps coming up is, are the returns justifying the investment?
And I think the answer is, for some players, clearly yes. For others, more complicated.
Describe the split.
Okay, so there's the infrastructure layer, the chip makers, the data center builders, the hyperscale cloud providers, and then there's the application layer, the companies actually building things on top of that infrastructure that customers pay for.
The picks and shovels versus the miners.
The picks and shovels versus the miners. And the historical analogy from previous tech waves is interesting here because the picks and shovels play has often done very well. The cloud providers did very well. The chip makers for mobile did very well.
So there's reason to think the infrastructure players and AI could capture a lot of value.
There is. But there's also a scenario where the infrastructure gets commoditized faster than expected. If AI training compute becomes more efficient, if the models get more capable with less compute, which has been a real trend, then the value of having built a lot of infrastructure at great expense starts to look different.
It's a bet on continued demand growth outpacing efficiency improvements.
And the demand growth has been there. Like, the efficiency improvements have happened, but the demand has grown faster, so the total compute consumption has kept going up. Whether that continues is the question.
And nobody knows.
Nobody knows, which is the honest answer.
Let's talk about something a bit different. There's been interesting coverage this week in the mainstream press about the cultural and societal dimensions of AI. The questions about dependency, about skill atrophy, about how AI is changing how we think.
Oh, I've been reading a lot of this and I have thoughts.
I know you do.
Okay. So there's this recurring debate, and I keep seeing it in two camps that talk past each other. Camp one, AI is liberating, it's expanding human capability, it's giving people access to things they never had before. Camp two, AI is creating dependency, it's atrophying important cognitive skills, we're outsourcing our thinking in ways we'll regret.
And both of these camps have evidence.
Both camps have real evidence. That's the frustrating thing. Like, camp one can point to a person who couldn't have written a business plan now can with AI assistance. A small business owner who couldn't afford a lawyer now has access to legal guidance they otherwise couldn't have gotten. A student with learning differences who struggled with writing can now produce work that represents their actual understanding. These are real benefits.
Real democratization of access to capability.
Real democratization. And camp two can point to the well-documented phenomenon of GPS dependency, reducing our ability to navigate without it. Calculators in classrooms and the debates about what happens to arithmetic fluency. Spell check and people who've lost confidence in their own spelling.
There's a genuine pattern there across multiple technologies.
There's a real pattern. You outsource the function to the tool, you use the freed up mental capacity for something else, or you just free it up, and you lose some native ability to do the thing without the tool.
And the question is whether that's a bad thing.
Whether it's a bad thing, which is actually not obvious. Like, I don't navigate with maps anymore. I've definitely lost some of that skill, but I don't really need that skill. I have GPS, which is reliable and better than my memory of the map.
But you might need your ability to reason through a problem independently in a way that GPS doesn't have a good analogy for.
That's the disanalogy that worries me. Like, the ability to think through complex problems without AI assistance might be more important to preserve than navigation ability, because thinking is more fundamental to what makes humans valuable.
And harder to verify that you still have it when you haven't exercised it in a while.
Right. Like, I find out I've lost my navigation skills pretty quickly if GPS goes down. But if I've gradually outsourced my deep thinking to AI, I might not notice the atrophy until I need it in a high-stakes situation.
And then it's too late.
And then it's too late. So I think the responsible position on this is use AI to extend your thinking, not to replace it. Use it to go further and deeper than you could alone, not to avoid thinking altogether. And that's a discipline that you have to actively choose.
It requires intentionality.
It requires intentionality that the tools themselves don't impose, which is why the cultural and educational response matters. You can't rely on the technology to enforce good use habits. That has to come from somewhere else.
This connects to something I was reading about this week regarding creative work and AI. The intersection of AI and creative industries has been a big story.
Very big story.
And it's different from the technical coding story in interesting ways. Because in creative work, the process often is the point. Like, the act of writing, the act of making art, that's not just a means to an end. It's often a form of thinking, a form of working through things.
Right. You write to understand what you think. The writing isn't just conveying a preformed thought, it's forming the thought.
So if you use AI to generate the writing, you may get the output, but you've skipped the cognitive work that the act of writing was doing.
Which is a real loss, even if the output is good.
Even if the output is good.
And I think this is where the framing of AI as a tool versus AI as a replacement is most important. Used as a tool, as something that you engage with, push back on, iterate with, it can actually enhance the thinking and the creative process. Used as a replacement, type a prompt, accept the output, you've skipped the thing that mattered.
and distinguishing between those modes is important.
And not always easy to do, which is why these conversations matter.
All right, I want to round out the news section by touching on the AI startup and investment ecosystem, because there's been some interesting movement there this week.
Yeah, the VC landscape around AI has been fascinating and also kind of volatile lately.
Volatile is the right word. The enthusiasm around AI investments has been enormous. Enormous amounts of capital flowing into the space. And you're now starting to see more differentiation in terms of which companies are actually building something sustainable versus which companies were riding a wave of excitement.
The wave has been big enough that a lot of things got funded that maybe shouldn't have been.
That's true in every technology bubble of enthusiasm. The enthusiasm raises all boats, including boats that don't have great hulls.
And then the tide goes out.
And what you're seeing in the coverage this week is some clear signals about which companies have genuine product market fit, users who pay and come back because the product is genuinely valuable, versus which companies have impressive demos and investor enthusiasm without underlying business fundamentals.
The demo to product gap has been significant in AI because demos are genuinely impressive. These models can do amazing things in a demo.
And then you try to build a production system on top of it, and you encounter all the edge cases and failure modes and reliability questions that demos don't surface.
Building production-grade AI products is much harder than the demos make it look. And the companies that have figured that out, that have solved the reliability, the latency, the integration, the cost-at-scale problems, those companies have real, defensible value.
Anthropic sits at an interesting position in this landscape because it's both a research lab and a product company. It has to do both things well.
And historically, those are hard to do simultaneously. The cultures are different. Research culture is about exploring and being wrong in interesting ways. Product culture is about reliability and user value and shipping things that work. Holding both is hard.
And Anthropic seems to be navigating that reasonably well. The research output continues to be serious. The safety work, the interpretability work, and the product side with Claude and Claude Code is clearly finding users who value it.
The session management feature we talked about today is actually a good example of that. That's a product culture win. It's not a research breakthrough. It's a really thoughtful understanding of how developers actually work and an implementation that serves that.
And it sits on top of a research foundation that makes the underlying AI good enough to be worth having persistent sessions with.
Right. The research foundation enables the product. The product shows you what the research needs to improve. They feed each other.
Virtuous cycle.
Very virtuous cycle, when it works.
All right, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. Any last thoughts before we head into the close?
I just keep coming back to the session management thing. I know we spent a lot of time on it, but I think it's genuinely underrated as a development. The best developer tools are the ones that get out of your way and let you do your actual thinking and building. And a session management system that means you never have to reestablish context, that lets you branch your exploration, that travels with your project. That's a get out of your way feature. That's infrastructure for thinking.
Infrastructure for thinking. I like that framing.
Thank you.
I'll steal it.
Please do.
All right, that is going to do it for Claude Daily on this Friday, June 12th, 2026. This has been a good one.
Really good episode. A lot to think about on a Friday morning.
If you're a developer and you've been vaguely aware of Claude Code but haven't really dug into it, today's a good day to actually explore the session management documentation. It's well written, it explains the concepts clearly, and I think it will change how you think about what's possible with AI-assisted development.
And if you are already a heavy Claude Code user and you haven't been using sessions aggressively, that's a workflow upgrade waiting for you. Seriously, just try branching once on a real decision you're facing and see if it changes how you approach it.
Good advice. For the broader AI news landscape, there's a lot happening and we'll keep tracking it. The regulatory stories, the competition, the research, it's all moving fast and we're here every morning to help you make sense of it.
Every morning, Monday through Friday, here in your ears.
And as always, if you have thoughts on what we talked about today, if you're using Claude Code in interesting ways and want to share, if you have a different take on anything we said, we genuinely want to hear it.
Genuinely. I read everything.
He does. For Sam, I'm Alex. Have a fantastic Friday, enjoy your weekend, and we will see you back here Monday morning for another edition of Claude Daily. Take care, everyone.
Have a good one.